20 years ago, we got an aquarium here in Southern California, in Long Beach to be more specific, that has grown and grown and grown and has really become an interesting educational piece for the community. It's called the Aquarium of the Pacific. It's in its 20th year, and so we asked some of the officials from the aquarium to come join us to talk about what they're doing, their critters, and global warming. Now, all of us can go, doo-doo.
Actually, I like it. It's one of my favorite movies growing up.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear everybody from the Aquarium of the Pacific. Happy 20th anniversary to you. 20th year.
20 years and still going.
Jerry Schubel. Schubel. Hal Eisner. Or as we like to say, what the hell, right? Nate.
Jaros.
And Rob Mortensen.
Now, you know, I think it's important to understand what 20 years is all about. We're talking about 1998. In 1998, who was president?
Warren Eilif. Oh, the equipment of the United States.
I was afraid you were going to say Warren Harding.
Warren Eilif, president of the Aquarium of the Pacific.
Oh, no, I was talking about president of the United States. That's pretty good, though. I didn't know that. tell me about the opening. It was auspicious. Rob, you were there.
I was. It was a lot of work. When I got to the aquarium, it was just a shell of a building and a mud patch around it. So we knew we had a lot of work to cover.
When you opened it, you opened it up with what? What was there?
A cat.
That's it.
Yeah, we had a cat. The local cat that ran around the construction grounds, and he was the first one. No, seriously, we added a lot of animals to it. I came up with the sea otters, which we held at another facility until we were ready for them. They got a lot more fanfare than I got when they came into the city. And we started, stocking up from, beg, borrowing, and stealing from everybody else.
One of the things that I always love about the Aquarium of the Pacific is when I walk into the building, they've got this like ceiling to floor aquarium. I don't know how many fish and sea life you have in there, but what do you have in the way of life in that aquarium? It's enormous.
Well, we're focused on three galleries, and that was always the historic setup for the aquarium. And we wanted to represent the Pacific Tropic, the Temperate Tropic, and the Cold Water Tropic up in Alaska and Kamchatka area. And we do that very well. So there's everything you'd find in every ecosystem from that Pacific Ocean range, which is a huge, huge range.
It's actually, I got to tell you something. I could sit there on one of those little benches and just watch that. I mean, it's mesmerizing.
It is. It's one of my favorite things before we open in the morning to do rounds and walk around and look and see the new things that we've put out, what the life is doing at that time.
It must be crazy trying to get up on a ladder and drop fish food in there.
Oh, yeah. Big fish food.
Hey, let me ask you, Nate. There's a lot of shark activity out there. That's an area that you're pretty tuned into. You have a lagoon with all kinds of sharks, and you have these this sort of lagoon area where you have these windows, and you can look at them, and they'll come right toward you. I don't know if they even see you, but they come toward you, and then they make a little bank to the right or a little bank to the left, and then there are these big manta rays or stingrays or whatever they are. It's crazy looking.
Yeah, we have a diverse group of sharks and stingrays.
How many do you have?
We've got about 15 animals in that exhibit of about 6 or 7 different species. There's also an area we call the Shark Lagoon Touch Pools, where guests can touch stingrays and sharks, and the kids really get a good connection with the animals.
One of the things I think that's interesting about any of these sort of facilities is the fact that you get to be up close and personal with critters that are not indigenous to the area. So it might be something like a penguin, maybe, that's from where, South America?
Yeah,
and we do. And we're not talking about, Texas or Louisiana. We're talking about South America, not the southern part of the United States of America. It's just so much fun to see these things up close and personal.
And that's what's important, I think. And this aquarium was the first aquarium that allowed people to touch sharks, for example.
Yeah.
We have many touch experiences. And as we're expanding, we're going to make it even more accessible to people who are deaf and blind, and that's a priority.
Well, that's
very
important. That's very important to make it available for those who have disabilities.
That's right.
Aren't there laws about that? Well, certainly, but in the walkways and stairs and things like that.
But that's only where it begins. We've always been ADA compliant. We're going way beyond that in our expansion.
One of the things we've talked about that I think is really fascinating that I'm really interested in and I want to know more about is this idea that there is one species that you're paying attention to as you go forward.
Yes. First of all, we have a great classical aquarium, and these two guys have been very important in developing that. Some of the world's best live animal exhibits. So now, as we go forward, we're going to focus on the one animal that's putting all the other animals on the planet at risk, and that animal is us. And this is important because unless we change direction, the only place you might be able to see many of these animals 50 years from now would be in aquariums and zoos. That's not what we want. And so we have to tell the story of these animals, what human beings are doing to them, and why it's so important to conserve them.
Is that to say that we've discovered the enemy and the enemy is us?
Yes, exactly. The enemy, very clearly, the enemy is us. And it isn't that we're not just affecting the other life on the planet. We're putting human life in jeopardy. And we may not go extinct, but the world is going to could be a very different place in 50 or 75 years. And so we have the knowledge, we have the science, we have the technology to put this Earth onto a more trajectory that's more sustainable.
A lot of people may not actually get that, but you and I have been around long enough to know that 50 years ago, the world was a very different place.
Even 20 years ago, yeah, the world was a different place. The rate of change is increasing, and we know how to slow it down, and we have to slow it down so nature can catch up.
So as you create exhibits and things for people to learn, what are you going to do that's going to focus on human beings? Well, what's going to change?
Well, in this expansion, it's all designed.
There's an expansion coming up. Let's say that first.
We're going to open in spring of next year.
And what's that going to be?
It's called Pacific Visions, and it will provide a platform to let people explore pathways to alternative futures and discover how we will determine that future.
Now, how are you going to do that? Are you going to have live humans narrating? Or is it going to be audio displays and video displays? What are you going to do?
All of those. There will be some live animal exhibits.
I'm a visionary.
There will be films.
I knew that, right?
Films. There will be interactives. There will be every technique and tool that we have at our disposal to telling big, powerful stories.
And no other aquarium in the United States is doing that?
Not to that extent, no.
Why did you choose to go there? I mean, let's face it, we're on the ocean. We're on the ocean. So we have a front row seat. But what was it that sort of made you say, we really need to go this way?
Well, we back in 2005, the board got together. We knew we had to expand because we knew that we were reaching our capacity, and on busy weekend days, it wasn't a great experience. So the question is, how do you expand? What will it be like? Do you make it a traditional aquarium wing? Do you do something else? And finally, after talking about it for months and I guess even years, the board decided, let's do something that really gets at the heart of the issue. And we knew all about climate change back then, and the ocean was getting warmer and more acidic, and species were going extinct more rapidly than ever before. So it was a process that we went through, and we brought in some of the world's best scientists, and we asked them, if you were going to have a new wing in an aquarium, what's the big story that you would tell?
You and I have talked about El Nino before.
Yes.
Which kind of actually turned out to be a bust. Right?
Yes.
We kind of thought it was going to be like right. this big thing, and it really, and the good news is it really wasn't a big thing.
Right.
You know, and I remember some of the criticism, but, you know, I think it's good news when something that you're worried about doesn't happen. But you know, I guess I'm fascinated by global warming, and you guys really understand that a whole lot better than an awful lot of folks. So what's happening out in the Pacific Ocean?
Well, I mean, as the ocean warms, it puts a lot of animals at risk. It makes some animals move into ranges that they don't normally live in. Corals that can't move and can't adapt, just die, which kind of tears down a very valuable and intrinsically and commercially resource for our planet. So, I mean, there's a lot of negatives with.
But I guess I want to understand. Let's just take the last decade. What has changed in the Pacific Ocean?
Oh, lots. Sea level rise is a constant problem, and I think you see that in communities that border the sea levels. You know, whether it's in Indonesia, which is already fairly flat, or whether it's up in Alaska, you're seeing a lot of villages are having to move back literally from the water's edge. So that's probably the most direct and obvious effect that you see. But we see it all the time in the animals. We see changing fish stocks, where they hang out, where they go to feed. The currents change. The animals that prey on the fish change. We're seeing a lot of that with penguin species, where they simply can't find the food near enough to shore anymore because the food moves away from shore. And that's where the adults have to eat and catch food to bring to the chicks. So it really has a dynamic effect on a lot of animals. Probably one of the most notorious ones that we're watching closely is polar bears. The sea ice is shrinking. There's not enough sea ice up there for the polar bears to live on and hunt from. And so that's one that we really use as a marquee to really tell the story of ocean change and climate change.
So let's see if we can drill down on this a little bit.
Sure.
Because I think it's a great topic. I understand a lot. I've been to Alaska like three times. I've been out on the glaciers. I've whitewater rafted down the Mendenhall River. I mean, I love that. Love that place up there. But, you know, I get it when the temperature is warming a couple of degrees, the ice is melting, the glaciers are calving, and this has an impact on the water up there. Why here? Why are we seeing changes here? Just sort of walk me through that.
Well, the ocean's all connected. And so if you're going to have a change in any part of the ocean, you're going to feel it somewhere else, maybe to a lot less degree. But it's going to impact the whole world. The ocean is all connected. Whether we're talking the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean, it's one world ocean. So even though we focus our efforts on the Pacific Ocean, we're really talking about a global ocean and a global experience.
There's more water than there is land.
There is. There's, you know, 70-something percent of the world is covered by ocean or covered by water. And the topics vary from freshwater scarcity to ocean acidification to global ice shrinking to glaciers calving, like you mentioned. It just, the list goes on and on and on of global climate change.
And all of this affects the animals.
Yes,
it affects the sea life.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting that right here in the Southern California Bight, that it's the area that goes from Point Conception down to Tijuana, and every day, scientists at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography have been measuring the temperature of the surface water at the end of Scripps Pier. And they had the highest temperature in 102 years in August. It was almost 80 degrees. That begins to, as I have pointed out, it affects fish stocks, it affects kelp beds. It has big impacts. The ocean is changing. The other important part that's changing is that the oxygen levels in the ocean are decreasing at all levels. We get half of the...
Do you measure that, by the way?
We do not, no.
Okay.
We do primarily what's called secondary research. So we carefully follow all the primary research that's being done, and we bring those people to the table, the leading researchers, and we ask them, what are the big stories the public needs to know about? And then we translate those into stories that engage, educate, and empower.
So as you're talking about expanding and trying to do things that teach us, it's a teaching facility.
Yes.
That teach us how to keep us from destroying our neighbors to the west under the water and so forth. Is global warming a big part of this in your expansion?
And it has been, yes. It's been a big part of the aquarium for the last decade. And I think we're what's called an informal learning institution. So we're not teaching in the sense of formal classroom didactic kind of teaching. We're letting people explore and learn.
But that's largely what these informal teaching facilities do. You go to a planetarium,
that's right,
like Griffith Park here in Los Angeles, you're going to see all kinds of displays informally to learn. You're not going into a classroom to get your doctorate or something, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
I think one of the things that that we do at the aquarium is, in addition to the informal learning, is inspire, connect people to animals that they otherwise wouldn't probably be able to see. And we can do a lot, and we do a lot. I think we do it well with a lot of our aquariums, our glass boxes. But I think what Jerry's vision is this telling stories that you can't tell.
But also, I think that's the point about the penguins. penguins. Mm-hmm. You have penguins from South America. You bring them up here. The kids get to see them. Otherwise, they just see pictures.
That's right.
You know, I always thought with my kids, if we travel, the kids will do better in school because they'll know what a valley is, a mountain is, a river. They'll know what a glacier looks like. You take them and you show them, and then they actually have an experience of what that's like as opposed to just seeing it in a book like I did when I was right. a kid. And geography was something I loved, but I didn't, you know, I lived in a flat place in Texas. I didn't know what a valley was because we didn't have any.
But people at least taught you geography. We don't teach geography anymore, and that's a tragedy.
Yeah. But I do like this notion of, you know, these informal learning centers. I just think that's a great way. It's exciting. You know, before we did this podcast, I have a show called Fox 11 News In Depth, and we did a television program about this and a couple of other things. And one of the writers brought his daughter in because, you know, I gave him a tip that we were going to have all these animals in the studio, and he said, I'm going to go get my daughter. I think she'd love to see that. Well, she was like, you know, her eyes were like as big as golf balls, you know? And, well, that's sort of the wonder, isn't it? That's sort of the kid sort of feeling of, wow, look at that. It's a wow thing.
Yeah, well, you know, you talked earlier about growing up in a flat place. I grew up in the Midwest in Illinois. And as a kid doing field trips to the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, I fell in love with it. And here I am 30 years later, and I've worked in a public aquarium most of my adult life. And I've dedicated myself to doing what I can to help out with conservation, whether it be ocean or whether it be land-based. I will tell you a story. I met a girl who was a young girl, teenager from Bakersfield, and she came to the aquarium, saw the penguins for the first time. You know what she said? I didn't know they were real. I thought they were something made up.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, and that, why not? Why wouldn't you think that if you see them in cartoons, but you don't see them in real life? And so it translates something in a way that can only be translated by seeing it for real.
Yeah, absolutely. You can do so much with technology, but seeing live animals where you can is huge. And then if you can't, you know, some of the stories we can't tell with just the live animals alone, that's where Pacific Visions comes in, and it's a great resource for us.
You know,
that really helps us to bridge the gap.
But you know, Rob is right. The live animals are the magnet. They're what bring people to the aquarium. Once they're there, we have an opportunity, and some of us believe actually a responsibility, to tell these bigger stories.
I know that you have activities every month, all kinds of things going on. And just generally speaking, what kinds of activities do you tend to have throughout the year?
Well, we have a lecture at least once a week. In fact, Rob's going to give one tonight. We have aquatic forums where we give these mini...
That is a teaching experience right there.
That is a teaching
experience. It's like a classroom.
Yeah, that way, yeah.
Well, for the informal thing.
that only happens after dark. And we have an aquatic academy, which are short courses for adults about issues that are timely and often controversial.
And controversial, too, are things about sharks. And I want to talk about that for a minute, because recently a man was killed by a shark off the Cape Cod coast. This past year, we had incidents involving sharks in a boat and sharks in a surfboard. And so I know that one of the things you guys prefer not to do is demonize sharks, and that's what Hollywood does so well. But sharks do have big teeth, and lots of them, and they can be problematic.
They play their role in the ocean. They're top predators. Do we demonize people? We're the top predator on the planet.
Well, there are people that we demonize because they deserve it. But, you know, but I mean, you know, a shark, you get in the water, and I think, you know, Nate and I talked about this earlier. You get in the water, and you see, you know, the fin going around. What are you supposed to do?
Well, I think, yeah, we want to stress that people be safe around the ocean.
I mean, but if you start splashing as you're trying to get away, you may be viewed as a seal.
Exactly. And that's generally what scientists think a lot of shark attacks are, mistaken identity, that we're people are inhabiting the zones of the prey of these top predators.
Well, we're mammals, too.
Mammals, and yes. And the sharks prey on the sick and the injured first. So if you're a bad swimmer or splashing or frantic, those things signals to the sharks.
But what is the role of global warming in this? Are these sharks coming closer to us because the water is, maybe the levels are going up and the seals are coming closer, and so the whales are looking for their food and the water seems deep, so they're continuing on and they're getting closer to we are?
It's hard to say, and I don't know if the science is complete on that one, but I think that what we do know is that the more people that go into the water, the more likelihood of that. And as water is warm, more people may enjoy areas or spend time in the water where maybe they hadn't before, or maybe only a few people did in wetsuits. And, you know, that is hard to say.
But again, you know, I think one of the things that's important, and you can pick up on this, one of the things that I think is important is the fact that we're all neighbors.
We're all neighbors.
Those are our underwater neighbors, right. And we're the on-land neighbors, and somehow we have to understand each other. Now, they won't understand us as well as we can understand them.
That's right. So that means we have a greater responsibility.
And that gets back to your vision.
And that gets back to our collective vision for the Aquarium of the Pacific.
Which is trying to protect the animals before we do them in.
Correct.
Exactly. Well, and I think Jerry said it before, we're trying to protect ourselves as well. If we don't start with the animals and the plants, which are always forgotten in this equation, there's not going to be a habitable space for us.
Well, it's not only just we're a food chain, right? Mm-hmm. So the sharks are on the top of that food chain. That's why they're called apex predators. And lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And so there's you know, this sort of triangular thing that works its way down. But that's part of the food chain. Mm-hmm. And so we start messing with that. What happens?
Well, there's a food chain in the ocean, and there are food chains on land also for different species. So, and one of the things, though, that if you look at the impacts of the ocean, other than overfishing, the largest impacts on the ocean come from human activities on land, things we do here, primarily the kinds and amounts of energy we use, the ways we grow and harvest our food, and also, to some extent, population explosion and our consumption patterns.
And then in some cases, I would say what call them man-made catastrophes like oil spills and, you know, things like that can really destroy animal life?
They can, but those are less important than the chronic stresses that are there year after year, decade after decade. That's what global warming does. Nature's pretty resilient. Nature is not fragile the way some people would have us believe. Nature is very resilient. She's tough, and it can respond and rebound from incidents. The chronic stresses, that's what really takes a toll.
And can I make a point about
the
sharks?
Please.
Just to maybe add on to that, especially about rebounding, as Jerry says. One reason that we really like to talk about shark conservation at the aquarium is that sharks, unlike a lot of other fish, take years to become sexually mature. And when many of the species, when they reproduce, have very small births. Quantities in their burrs or litter sizes, so that means that they take an extremely long time to recover. So at the rate that they're being overfished for practices like shark finning, which is incredibly wasteful, where only the fin of the shark is taken, and they decimate millions of sharks each year, those populations are going to take lifetimes to rebound to where they could be. So I think demonizing sharks, yes, they there is a likelihood that there's small, very small statistical likelihood that they injure people. And I mean, our hearts go out to the friends and family of people who like that person out in Cape Cod. But I mean, the real heart of the issue for us is that those animals should be protected.
Yeah, but you know, how much impact do movies, does Hollywood do in sort of portraying these sharks as monsters? And I, you know, understand the, you know, you have King Kong and you have Godzilla and then you have sharks and but what is the ramification of that? What are the unintended consequences of that?
So Peter Benchley, after he made Jaws, he felt so badly about his demonizing of sharks. He spent the rest of his life trying to correct the perception of sharks. When I was living in Boston, we worked with him and made a couple of movies. He spent the rest of his life trying to clarify the role of sharks in the ocean and why they are important to.
I didn't realize that. Where were you working in Boston?
At the New England Aquarium.
Quite a bit different than here.
Very different.
But you know Cape Cod.
I do know Cape Cod.
And you understand what happened off that coast.
Yes.
With the shark attack.
Yes, absolutely.
What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, I was very upset, very sorry. You have to put these things into perspective, I think, though. On that weekend, I wonder how many people were killed on highways because of people who were drunk. The probability of being attacked by a shark is vanishingly small.
And is it like getting hit by lightning?
Even less.
Even less, I would say.
If you're really worried about an animal, mosquito is the number one killer on the planet. you know, from malaria. We don't talk nearly about as much of that because it's not demonized. They don't make movies about killer mosquito swarms. But really, between West Nile and some of the other newer things that mosquitoes are carrying along with the historical carrying of malaria, that's the real problem animal. And that's something that we spend a lot of money and a lot of time investing in, but it doesn't get the notoriety that sharks do.
It's been interesting to have this conversation. I didn't know about Peter Benchley. That was interesting to hear. And all of you have contributed a lot of really interesting stuff for me. I mean, I feel like I've been in a formal classroom, not an informal one. No, but seriously, you know, I want you each to take a moment and just sort of do a bottom line here, because what is it you want people to understand? Let me start with Rob.
I think people want to have a well-rounded opinion of what's going on in the world so that we don't focus in too narrowly on any one subject. It's all interconnected, and there's a lot that we can do. Jerry said earlier that people are the problem, but people are also the solution. We're trying to get that across to them, and we're trying to give them the choices so that they can see what's possible.
And are there times that, you know, when people go, what the hell is going on out there? What would you say?
Well, I think they need to think what they can do themselves to make a change. Everybody thinks that it's impossible to make a change just locally. But, you know, if you start locally, I think act locally and think globally, I think so you can we can all start to make a change.
Well, we're all part of a community.
Yeah, and support the scientists, support the people who are doing the groundbreaking work that can maybe start changing some of these effects on our climate.
Jerry, you got the bottom line.
Well, we are part of a global community now, and we very clearly are on an unsustainable path, a path to an unsustainable future. And Archimedes once said, give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum upon which to place it, and I shall move the world. We have the levers. We have the fulcrum. The primary levers are energy, food, and population, and the fulcrum is the ability to communicate instantaneously around the world. Last year, 5 billion people around the world had cell phones, and over half the population had access to the internet. Instead of doing some of these silly things we do with these devices, we should be building communities of change to move this planet onto a sustainable pathway.
My thanks to all the folks over at the aquarium. Happy 20th anniversary to you guys. And if you enjoy our podcast, do me a favor, give us 5 stars, you know, if you like it. And you can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, or anywhere where you get podcasts. And we'll see you next time.